December 7th. It was exactly 77 years ago today that the Imperial Japanese Navy executed a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, pulling the United States into World War II. More than 2,000 American servicemen were killed that day. Many could not be identified and were buried in anonymous graves. An agency within the Pentagon has the mission of identifying these unknown casualties of war, and much of their work happens on the same base that was attacked in 1941. HPR's Ryan Finnerty tells us more.
So this area has different names. I mean, sometimes people call it the Education Center or whatever, but it's basically where we can start walking through.
I'm standing outside a large open room. Inside that room are dozens of lab tables, each one holding a human skeleton.
These are actual remains of U.S. service members that we are in the process of identifying.
That was Dr. William Belcher, a forensic anthropologist with the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency, the DPAA. He helps oversee one of two forensic laboratories used by the United States military to identify the remains of American service members killed in our nation's wars. Belcher's focus is on the final step of that mission, identification. But he told me it can take years of research before a set of remains arrives in the lab.
It's all based on a historical foundation of the historical research. So we have several different kinds of materials that we look at. Some are missing aircrew reports, some are unit histories, some are dealing with individual deceased personnel files that have accounts of their loss, missing aircrew reports, things like that. So we have several, I would say tons, of paper data that we have, and we're in the process of digitizing all that. But so a lot of people, when they look at the lab, they want to say, oh, this is the lab, this is where everything happens. But it's not true. This is basically the last stage. And, you know, you could think of it as a pyramid where the foundation of the research is what allows us to go out and be successful in the recovery and then off into the identification.
Once researchers have determined the probable location of a plane crash or battlefield gravesite, teams of scientists and military escorts will travel there to do a field excavation. The DPAA has recovered remains from all over Europe, Asia, and the Pacific Islands. Investigation teams have even been able to work in restrictive nations like North Korea and China. But the agency also works to determine the identity of so-called unknowns, unnamed Americans buried in national cemeteries. That was the case with one group of particularly well-preserved skeletons.
These are sort of special cases because these are from buried as unknowns up in the National Cemetery of the Pacific, or National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific. They were found as unknowns. Most of this is dealing with Korean War. So everything we see in most of the bays here until we walk down to the end of the hall relate to the Korean War somehow. So these are primarily unknowns from the Korean War that were buried in the Punch Bowl Cemetery. And so because they were buried in caskets and things like that, they're very well preserved. But we do find other remains that are either on plane crashes that are more fragmentary, as well as have been exposed to the elements for 60-plus years.
Is there a typical condition for remains to come back in terms of either number or type of bones or tissue?
It just depends on the kind of incident. So if you have a high-speed jet aircraft during Vietnam that crashed in excess of 500 miles an hour and it was loaded with fuel, the bone is very fragmentary and burned, so it's a very high degree, so it almost looks like chalk. Whereas if you have a battlefield loss where somebody was buried in a fighting position like we see in North Korea, the bones are relatively well preserved, but the epiphyses of the ends of the bones tend to be eroded.
In a case like that, it can take some serious scientific ingenuity to determine even basic traits of the remains. Using display replicas, Dr. Belcher shows me just how hard it can be.
First thing is, like, if we have a collection of small fragmentary bone-like items, we want to separate out the non-bone. And so we have, for example, we have this fragment here that looks very much like a kneecap or a patella. Even the internal structure looks very much like that, but it's a piece of melted plastic.
So yeah, same shape, same size.
But it's a piece of plastic. And this here looks like it might be part of a finger, but it's actually a drip of fiberglass that's melted and dripped and formed a tear shape.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. Yeah, it even has the same kind of coloring that a bone might have.
So once we've separated out this non-osseous or non-bone material, then we want to look at, is it human animal or human bone? So one of the things that we want to do is, we've had people We have people on the staff that are experts in determining whether it's non-human animal versus human. And so some of the places that we go to excavate, people have been living for thousands of years. And so we do find people eating animals and discarding the remains in archaeological sites that have been reused as burial sites later on.
Once bones have been identified as human, work begins to identify physical traits of the deceased.
First thing is, like, if we have a collection of small fragmentary bone-like items, we want to separate out the non-bone. And so we have, for example, we have this fragment here that looks very much like a kneecap or a patella. Even the internal structure looks very much like that, but it's a piece of melted plastic.
So yeah, same shape, same size.
But it's a piece of plastic. And this here looks like it might be part of a finger, but it's actually a drip of fiberglass that's melted and dripped and formed a tear-shaped.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. Yeah, it even has the same kind of coloring that a bone might have.
So once we've separated out this non-osseous or non-bone material, then we want to look at, is it human animal or human bone? We have people on the staff that are experts in determining whether it's non-human animal versus human. And so some of the places that we go to excavate, people have been living for thousands of years. And so we do find people eating animals and discarding the remains in archaeological sites that have been reused as burial sites later on. So when we get some remains in and we begin to separate out into individuals, we want to perform what we call a biological profile. So this is where the forensic anthropologists come in. And the biological profile are the same kinds of things that you would see in the personnel file that we've been to compare that thing to. Male, is this person male or female? What is their race or ethnicity? How tall were they? How old were they? Those are the kinds of things that we want to try to look at. And so there's various indicators on the skeleton that we can begin to look at to determine that. And so if we have the pelvis or a fragment of the pelvis, we can help determine whether it's male or female based on different structure or aspects of it. Dealing because the female pelvis really is, through evolution, designed to birth this very large brain primate. And about 98 to 99% of the casualties that we're looking for are men, of course.
And I've heard anecdotally that some of the technicians can even tell the race of the deceased just by looking at the bones or, you know, make an informed guess. Mm-hmm. What are some of the indicators of that?
Well, if we have the mid-facial area, we can determine what the ethnicity or the race of the individual is. And forensic anthropology tends to look at African, European, or Asian as our standard designations. And like I said, there are several things that we can look at that are characteristics on the mid-facial or the skull area. There's also measurements that we can do on the bone. Like this skull here that I'm holding in my hand is a Caucasian, and these are all casts, but this is a Caucasian male. Caucasians tend to have a pretty small face. They also have a very narrow nose area, nasal area. And they also have very smooth spatulate-shaped teeth on the inside, on the lingual or tongue side of the teeth.
On the inside of the teeth.
Yeah. When we look at an Asian skull, because of the cheekbones, it tends to be a relatively large face. So, but we also have a relatively flat nasal area up here between the eyes. But the key thing also is that we have, you can see here, where there's sort of a dimple inside. And we call this shovel-shaped incisors because these look like an old-time snow shovel that you might see, not so much here in Hawaii.
These are the front two teeth.
Yeah, the front two teeth on the back, the lingual side. And so they have this divot on the inside, and this is called shovel shaping. This is very characteristic of about 98% of all Asian populations, and that includes Native Americans. And so these are some of the characteristics. There's other things, like I said, that we can look at of dealing with the shape of other bones as well as measurements on bones.
And it's probably somewhat uncommon for you to get a perfectly preserved skull like this, I would imagine, right?
Battlefield losses, it's relatively common. In some of the unknowns that were buried, like from Pearl Harbor attack, those are also relatively well preserved. But if you have an aircraft crash site and things like that, it's not so common.
In another part of the lab, we saw some of those Pearl Harbor unknowns. They were distinct from other sets of remains because the bones were almost completely black. Dr. Belcher said that's characteristic of casualties from the 1941 attack. Oil from destroyed and damaged ships penetrated all the way to the bones of sailors entombed in ships like the USS Oklahoma, the West Virginia, and the California. This has actually made identifying the sailors a little bit easier.
The oil and fuel from the ships, which is actually, when you think about it, people think, oh, they got saturated with oil, that's a bad thing. It's actually a very good thing because it inhibits microbial or fungal growth, and that fungal or microbial growth actually contaminates the DNA. So actually inhibiting that with the oil is a really good thing.
The agency is currently focusing on identifying remains from the USS Oklahoma, which sunk at Pearl Harbor with more than 400 men lost. Currently, DPAA has identified almost 200 of those. Work also continues on 50 unknowns from the USS California and the West Virginia. In many cases, it has only recently become possible to make those identifications. A set of remains may lie in storage for years before scientists develop the techniques necessary to confirm a service member's identity. DPAA scientists are currently exploring how radioactive isotopes in the body could be used to determine things like where a person lived and where they grew up.
So different isotopes occur in basically the groundwater or the bedrock of different areas in the world. So we're looking at things like carbon, oxygen, strontium, and nitrogen. Those are the four main ones. This is an old technique that's been used in archaeology, but we're starting to use it in forensics now. And what it is that you basically are what you eat or ingest or where you live. And so those isotopes get into your bones and they're preserved. And different isotopes give you a different picture of somebody, what they were eating or where they were living 2 weeks ago, where they grew up, where they may have moved off to, things like that. So different aspects that we can look at. But what we're trying to develop is what we call isoscapes, or a landscape of isotopes. And so we can look at that to determine where somebody lived. So if we have, let's just say for Korea, we have 5,000 casualties that we have in a group. And if we can say we need to narrow that down to a smaller number. And so we can say, okay, well, this guy's isotope signature matches L.A. And so we can say, okay, now we're just going to look at the L.A. casualties. And so, but if you look at a landscape of the United States, it's very colorful using different codes because the isotopic composition of the bedrock is very different. And this is the same thing that is used in different kinds of forensic and criminal cases like counterfeit Kobe beef. Because Kobe beef is from Kobe, Japan. And it can't be sold if it's under that name unless it's from Kobe, Japan. And so you can actually test the meat to determine where it came from in Japan. And it's the same concept. So we're using the bones to test where this person originally came from.
As we walked through the lab, one particular set of bones caught my eye. A partial skeleton was wrapped in an olive-green wool army blanket and covered in dirt. A patch of jet black hair still clung to the skull.
These are remains that we exhumed from the punch bowl this morning, and that they're in the process of being cleaned to prep for analysis.
And so where is this person from, do we know?
North Korea.
So this is a
person that died in North Korea and was brought back as what's called Operation Glory, where we exhumed the POW cemeteries in the 50s and brought the remains back here, and then they were buried. They couldn't analyze them, they could analyze them, but they couldn't determine the identification back in the 50s, and so they were buried as unknowns. And so the remains are usually, they were processed and then wrapped in a standard Army wool blanket.
I was going to say, it looks like a field blanket.
Yep. Wow. This is a tradition that's within mortuary affairs and graves registration services, is that the bodies are wrapped in a wool blanket. And then sent home for burial.
I just exhumed this morning.
For Dr. Belcher, this type of work has a very personal element.
I come from a military family. I never served, but my father was in the military for 23 years. So he fought in Korea and Vietnam. And so I have a different perspective on this because, except for the grace of God, my dad could be one of these people. So when I'm working on a case, that's how I think in the back of my mind, is that I want to do the best job I can because this could be my father.
That sentiment was echoed by the agency's director, retired Air Force General Kelly McKegg. He's a graduate of Damien Memorial School in Honolulu and came home to mark the 77th anniversary of Pearl Harbor.
For us, it's a commitment to the service members themselves who made the ultimate sacrifice in defense of this nation, its liberties, and its freedoms. But there's also a commitment to the families of the missing. Those are the ones we primarily serve. For the veterans whose comrades in arms are missing, there's that sense of connection, that sense of recovery. But it sends a strong signal to the veterans of all wars that this nation will spare no expense. And the last category that I think this work speaks to are those currently serving in uniform, that this nation will spare no expense to ensure that they, should they go missing, will be brought home to their families.
And why do you think the United States and the U.S. government have made such a point to create this mission and to fund it when other nations don't necessarily share that commitment?
Number one, I think it defines us as a nation, that the values that we've placed on service to country, on the fact of individuals going off to combat and making the supreme sacrifice, is something that we have that sacred obligation, almost a moral imperative too, that I think this, again, speaks to our values, that you know, this is something that, again, defines us as to who we are as a nation, that we commit the resources, the energy, and the focus toward this effort.
We don't really have any missing, any MIA service members from 20 years of war in Iraq or Afghanistan, which is a good thing. But do you think that you folks are going to work yourselves out of a job someday?
We won't, because unfortunately the numbers are staggering. From the conflicts that we work, we're bounded by World War II through Operation Iraqi Freedom. There are 82,000 that are still unaccounted for. Now, a majority of them are deep water at sea losses, and so we estimate that the recoverable number is 34,000. But as you can see, doing the math, it is still a steep, staunch challenge ahead of us.
450 of those made the ultimate sacrifice 77 years ago today. From Pearl Harbor, I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And if you want to hear more about the POW MIA Accounting Agency's efforts to identify missing American service members, head over to our website. We'll have a longer interview with the agency's director posted there. Find it at hawaiipublicradio.org.